I'd now like to turn our conference call over today to Mr. George Friedman. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you. Hello, I'm George Friedman, FINRA's Director of Arbitration, and I'm delighted to welcome all of the neutrals, some 1,900, who have signed up for today's program. Our program today is on managing an efficient and expeditious arbitration process. It'll take a bit over an hour, and we're going to cover the following topics and agenda. First, I'll briefly cover some changes of interest to arbitrators, things going on here at FINRA in our neck of the woods, including case statistics and filing trends, things that we think are of interest to arbitrators. The bulk of our program today will be a panel discussion that I will moderate. I'll describe it a bit later. As most of you know, FINRA arbitrators previously requested that the next call-in workshop address their questions on how to handle challenging and difficult arbitration situations. For today, Professor Constantine Katsouris, I call him Gus, and David Robbins, two seasoned arbitrators, have accepted the challenge. Now, I've known Gus and Dave each, I think, over 25 years, and I promise you this is going to be an interesting and informative program here today. I'll introduce them more formally in a few minutes after I cover current events. Now, a couple of housekeeping details. As in the past, audio recordings of this workshop and previous workshops can be found on FINRA's website, www.finra.org. You'll find it under Resources for Neutrals. The recording for this particular workshop we're doing today will be up in a few days. Now for current events. On March 13th, the SEC approved a rule change that prevents an attorney, accountant, or other professional from being classified as a public arbitrator if that individual's firm derives $50,000 or more in annual revenue for the past 2 years for professional services rendered to industry clients. Now, that's not what the rule language says. I paraphrase. You can find the language as well as a regulatory notice describing it on our webpage. But basically, this is another in a series of changes we've made to tighten up the definition of public arbitrator. And it's an effort to perceive, to improve perceptions of the public arbitrator roster by restricting arbitrators who receive significant compensation from industry activity. So this rule should be read in context with the previous rule that was enacted a couple of years ago that said if an arbitrator's firm derives more than 10% of its revenue from industry activities, a law firm or an accounting firm, for example, that person could not be public. Tighten it up now to say if that 10%, if in any instance the number is more than $50,000 a year, looking back over the last couple of years, that person can't be public. Now, that rule is it went into effect June 9th, so we did a few things to implement the rule. The first is we surveyed the available public arbitrators to ask you about your activity. We sent emails or surface mail to about 3,000 available public arbitrators. We've heard from most of you, and we found only about 2% of the public arbitrators were impacted by the change. 2%. And so we've gone ahead and made those changes. Basically, if there was a change, if as a result of answering the questionnaire, your status changed, we contacted you. So I guess the bottom line on this one is silence means you're still a public arbitrator. Now, for the few of you who have not responded, and you probably know who you are, it's really, really important that you respond to the survey because as of June 9th, we made you unavailable to serve on any new cases. So no new assignments for any public arbitrator that has not completed the survey. Please do so if you haven't already done so. Second topic I'll discuss in my brief current events here is the, what we call the legacy office. You probably know that as the former New York Stock Exchange Arbitration Department. Now, as many of you recall, we consolidated the NESD and the NYSE regulation arbitration programs last summer. As of August 6, 2007, no new cases have been opened under the NYSE arbitration rules. Anything that was in-house, any pending cases on that date, of course, will proceed to a conclusion under the NYSE rules. We're down to about 119 cases. So as of yesterday, 119 cases were still pending at the former NYSE arbitration department. Again, we call it now the Legacy Office. That office is located at 20 Broad Street in New York City. What are we going to do? Our plans are as follows. Now, over time, you know, one can do the math and look at the trend. No new cases are being opened under those NYSE arbitration rules. Cases will continue to close out over time. My staff hears me refer to this as the bathtub draining out. It will drain out. So what we've been doing over time is moving the 20 or so staff who former NYSE staff who became FINRA staff last year, we moved them over to our operation at One Liberty Plaza in New York City. So as of now, we have 7 staff remaining at the Legacy office. At the end of July, all of them will be moved over physically to Liberty Plaza. A small number of them will continue to work on the pending NYSE cases and will handle them until the cases close out, whenever they will. So that's our plan. NYSE staff will all be under one roof, literally, the former NYSE staff, under one roof, literally, here at One Liberty Plaza by the end of July. A small number of them will continue to work on the cases in-house. Finally, case filings and trends. Now, those of you who've heard me speak on this topic before might recall that I've referred to our arbitration filings as being counter-cyclical to the market. So it's basically, if the market's doing well, you know, our caseload tends to dry up a bit. Not surprising. People tend not to fight so much when they're making money, and they tend to fight more when they do make money, when they don't make money. So our caseload over the last few years has been declining. That's no longer the case. Things have turned around this year for reasons I think you probably all know. I'll describe a few of them. But here are the numbers. Reversing a long-term decline, really since 2004, we've now experienced a 22% increase in filings through the end of May. Just looking at the same 5-month period compared to last year, case filings in the arbitration part of our business are up 22%. I took a peek at the month-to-date numbers, and I can tell you through June that trend is continuing, if not accelerating. Again, the market events have changed a bit, and a couple of things have developed. The increase in case filings is being driven in large part by filings involving subprime mortgages and auction rate securities. The subprime cases, and we began tracking those as of January 1, through yesterday, were about 280 cases, so 280 subprime year-to-date. Auction rate, which we only began tracking in March, were about 88 cases year to date. So they continue claims involving those two cases continue to drive our caseload, as well as overall market fluctuations. So summing up, things have changed. And one of the calls we used to get is, when is the caseload going up? I think we can probably answer that question. The caseload is going up. We sometimes feel a little awkward about that. You know, we take great interest in market events driving our caseload, but that is where things stand today, and we don't think that trend will change. Okay, that's about it for current events. On to the main event. Let me introduce our panel. Professor Konstantin Gus Katsouris is chairman of the Securities Industry Conference on Arbitration, but more importantly is a Wilkinson Professor of Law at Fordham University Law School. Gus is also a public arbitrator here at FINRA. He's a chairperson trainer. He's a mediator, and is also an arbitrator at the American Arbitration Association, a private law judge, and serves on the board of editors at the Securities Arbitration Commentator. I could go on and on, but short and sweet, Gus is qualified. He knows what he's talking about. Dave Robbins is a partner at the law firm of Kaufman, Feiner, Yeaman, Gilden, and Robbins, LLP, here in New York. He's author of the Securities Arbitration Procedure Manual. He updates it every year. He's on FINRA Dispute Resolution's National Arbitration and Mediation Committee. I've mentioned that group before. This is a 15-person committee that advises FINRA on the operation of its arbitration and mediation operations. He also chairs the NEMC's Neutral Roster Subcommittee, which advises us on neutral roster issues. For about 20 years, Dave has chaired the Practicing Law Institute's annual program on securities arbitration, a little bit of a commercial. This year's program is taking place August 6th in New York City, and Dave has another great program lined up. I say it's great. That has nothing to do with the fact that I'm on the program along with some of my colleagues, Ken Andrzejczyk, Catherine Bayer, and Mignon McLemore. But it is a great program. And one little factoid folks might not know, but many years ago, Dave was director of arbitration at the American Stock Exchange. So he has walked in my shoes. Together, I think Gus and Dave have more than 60 years of combined service as arbitrators. You throw in my 30-plus years in the dispute resolution field, and I think we're centenarians here. Lots of experience at the table. So let's begin. First of all, I want to thank Gus and Dave for sharing their knowledge. I'm sure we're going to impart great knowledge and wisdom to those listening to us. Now, our program today is managing an efficient and expeditious arbitration process. The way we've set up the program, we've received questions from many of you via email, and those questions have led us to structure the program along three major themes. We'll first look at issues that arise at the pre-hearing conference and how to use the pre-hearing conference to move cases along. We'll then focus on discovery. That's clearly an important pre-hearing issue. And then we'll spend a fair amount of time talking about managing the actual hearing and what goes on. So within those three areas, I'll pose questions to Gus and Dave. Most likely I'll lose control shortly thereafter. But these two gentlemen have pretty much seen everything that we're going to throw at them shortly. So before we get to the first area of discussion, let's get a little more insight into your combined years of service. Let me just start out with an easy one. Rough estimate, how many cases do you think you've been appointed to in any form? How many arbitrations or mediations?
In my case, a couple of hundred.
That was Gus.
Yeah. About the same with me.
Interesting. Okay, great. So, again, I'm sure you've seen everything we're going to throw at you. Here's the first one. We're starting now with our first broad theme, which is the pre-hearing conference and how to move that along. I'll ask the first question to myself. We ought to define the pre-hearing conference. That's a tool we use where arbitrators meet with the parties or the counsel and basically go through an agenda to figure out how best to manage the process. Here's the first question. You're on an initial pre-hearing conference. We will use IPHC. That's what we call it here. And one of the attorneys, claims he or she has a conflict and can't do hearing dates for more than a year. So you're going through the agenda, and you go, all right, when should we schedule the first hearing or hearings? And one of the attorneys says, I'm just really busy. I can't do this for a year. And what do you do there, Gus?
Just let me preface that, George, before I get into the specifics of the attorney. The unavailability of people really falls into four categories: the attorney, the parties, the arbitrators, and even witnesses. And at that first hearing session, you've got to get your hands on all of it. I'm just going to touch upon the attorney's part, and then I think Dave will pick it up from there. As far as the unavailability of attorneys, it usually falls into one of two categories, either the claimant's attorney or the respondent's attorney. Usually you don't have the problem with a claimant's attorney because they're eager to prosecute the claim and see it to a finish. Sometimes you will, but usually the clients themselves are very, very impatient under those circumstances. The problem usually arises with the respondent's attorney, I've had it happen to me several times where they'll come in and say they're busy and they can't take on the case for a year, let's assume. Usually respondents are represented by larger law firms or with partners, and a year is much too long. I mean, you'd never get away with it in a criminal case or other jurisdictions. Somebody else can fill in. Nobody's indispensable, and you have no real, I won't say right, but it really throws everything off to impose upon everybody. And I then have quite a bit of a voir dire and try to jawbone them into narrowing it down or getting a replacement attorney. And that, in my case, has usually worked quite successfully. If a party told me and insisted that they couldn't do it for a year or more, I then would consider moving on and seeing what I would do. But I would not let it sit there. It's just not fair. I've seen some challenging, one of the most challenging situations that I encountered was relatively recently, where one of the respondent's attorney showed up and then had to leave because there was a conflict with another co-defendant in a similar case in another hearing. So this particular defendant presented to us a series of delays as he shopped around for a replacement attorney. And this happened two or three times. One of the sacred things is the person has a right to be represented by the attorney. On the other hand, we made a record. We gave him several adjournments to get an attorney, and finally he ended up representing himself pro se. But if you go that route, you've got to make a record and make sure that you've given him every opportunity.
Dave? George, you know, the overriding theme, the takeaway that I'd like my fellow arbitrators to take from this program, this next hour program, is arbitrator authority and power. Some of you are fearful that the court, when reviewing your conduct, will vacate your award. That fear is unfounded. Courts will overwhelmingly hold and not second-guess you on your exercise, your reasonable exercise of the powers that you have, and any decision that you make based on your evaluation of the evidence. So if nothing else in this next hour, I really want you to know that the courts, the statutes, the FINRA Code of Arbitration, it gives you tremendous power to expeditiously resolve cases. That is your default at all times. With respect to this issue, it's my experience that customers don't hire attorneys who tell them they can't bring their cases on an expeditious basis. It's also my experience that brokerage firms don't normally hire single practitioners to represent them. They have partners. Attorneys who say they can't conduct their hearings for a year probably never told that to their clients, who will be upset with such a scheduling request. So push them. For the sake of the client and the sake of the process, you schedule the hearings anyway.
Same question, but now it's the client, a client, who has similar problems about establishing dates for the hearing. What do you do? And I know the answer may depend on which side of this, but, you know, basically going through this, the attorney's willing and able, but the client has issues and can't schedule a date?
Yeah. I doubt the party is going to be the customer, because since I do represent customers, I know that they usually want their hearings yesterday. Let's assume it's the broker, since they're generally only two individual parties in the case. Corporate parties have representatives who can substitute for each other. So you tell the broker's attorney that the hearings are scheduled for certain dates and that if necessary, her client can be taken out of order. In arbitration, witnesses can be taken out of order to facilitate efficiency and expeditiously schedule a hearing. Lastly, parties generally attend all hearings. And while when they don't do it, it tends to send a message to us that maybe they don't care that much.
Got any insights?
I've had a couple of instances. I agree with everything Dave just said, but a couple of instances where illness of the party has cropped up. In the case of a claimant who was undergoing chemotherapy or whatever. So I think in a situation like that, you've got to bend the rule a little bit and be a little bit more lenient one way or the other. But other than that, I agree with everything David said.
I guess the byword is reasonable. You know, to Dave's point about arbitrators being overly concerned about their awards being vacated, you know, the Federal Arbitration Act, State Act, talk about failure to grant a reasonable postponement request, and you know, unless your actions were unreasonable, you're probably going to be sustained. I think that's the message to take away. All right, let's move on to discovery. This is our second major discussion area. It seems like, you know, we've all been in this. The three of us have been in the field, you know, pretty long time. Probably before
we get to that, I just we talk about the parties and the attorneys. I've also run into a couple of problems on occasion of arbitrator unavailability, and you've got to nail your fellow arbitrators down too, because then in the middle of the hearing they'll say, oh, I'm going to Florida for a month, or I'm doing this or I'm doing that. And I really think one of the things is you've got to nail that down too.
What I like to do, Gus, is have a teleconference with my fellow arbitrators before the IPHC, introduce myself, if I'm chairing the case, tell them how I like to run hearings, and finding out their schedule. So you know in before the IPHC if there's going to be a scheduling problem. If there is, say the case is up here, and the arbitrator says, I go down to Florida for 4 months, suggest that arbitrator withdraw.
And we've done a couple of articles in the Neutral Corner over the past few years addressing that general topic, or the topic of arbitrators causing postponements. And you know, we realize life intervenes for all of us, but I agree with you, Dave, and Gus, you know, taking seriously the obligation. You know, you signed on as an arbitrator, and you know, typically there are amounts of money at stake, and the parties are depending on the arbitrators to fulfill their obligations as well. Okay, on to discovery. My perspective, and I think we probably all agree, it seems to be more and more discovery disputes in arbitration that require arbitrator intervention to resolve. And that was certainly a driver back in late 1990s for us to produce the discovery guide, which went into effect in 99. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But let's start with some basics. What tools do you use to streamline the discovery process?
Well, you know, I was thinking about this question. It is so important. It's like what a good trial attorney does on cross-examination. He or she controls the witness. You as an arbitrator need to maintain control over all discovery conferences and hearings from the very outset. You set ground rules of behavior at the beginning, and you enforce them. You're the authority. Be polite. But be firm. Don't allow the parties to debate an issue once you've ruled on it. The IPHC introduces to the parties the option to proceed under the direct communication rule, that's 12211. This, I find, is the best tool we have at our disposal. It, however, requires a firm hand of the chair. If you agree to be the chair, you should, without question, strongly encourage parties to participate, but not abuse direct communication on contentious discovery issues. This, more than anything else prior to the hearing, can give your parties the greatest confidence in your desire to balance the need for efficiency with the need for a fair hearing. All arbitrators and all parties must agree to the use of direct communication before it can be used. And I have to tell you, I've never encountered a party who doesn't want to take part in the process. Not one. But I have encountered chairs who discourage it, thinking it will be too much work for them. Listen, you're going to have to decide contentious discovery issues anyway. Better now, when the issues are fresh in everyone's mind. It doesn't have to take a lot of time if you do it properly and you don't let the parties abuse the process. And listen, if you don't want to do it, you shouldn't be the chair.
Gus, any comments?
I do. I agree with everything that Dave says, and he's right, with a couple of differences of style. I like to, at the outset, and it doesn't take long, if the parties can solve their discovery issues themselves. I've had attorneys come and they've gotten along very well, a very contentious hearing, but they've got the discovery book, they have a joint exhibit, and the process worked beautifully. That is an arbitrator's dream. That doesn't always happen. In fact, sometimes it rarely happens. At that point, then, you've got to let the parties know that you're going to manage the discovery and be very firm about it. They can do it, again, by exchanging documents among themselves. When I find that it's not working, I then like to order a face-to-face hearing, like an actual hearing, with a record being kept. And then I have each side tell me exactly what they want, argue their point, I make a ruling, we decide it, it's on the record, and then they better adhere to that ruling. And you got to be firm about it. It's not that you want to be tough or you want to be, but you want to get the process and you want to be fair to people. And discovery, let's face it, games are played in discovery in any jurisdiction, whether it's arbitration or court. So the chairman has to exercise a firm control over it, as Dave said.
And of course, the code of arbitration procedure, which governs the arbitration, has specific rules on production of discovery, and incorporates by reference the discovery guidelines. A couple of words on the discovery guidelines. I think we know this, but it's worth saying. The discovery guidelines contain lists of presumptively discoverable items and materials for customer cases. We began a process a while ago to amend, to refresh, if you will, or update the discovery guide list. As I said, the discovery guide was made available in '99, late '99. And, you know, it's coming up on 9 years. So we took a look at it, working with the National Arbitration and Mediation Committee and other folks from the industry and customer side, and said, well, what do we need to do? What's superfluous to be taken out? What should we add? What changes should we make to accommodate developments over the last several years? So but the bottom line here is on June 11th, we filed with the SEC a proposal to amend the discovery guide. And at a high level, the improvements, among others, are to expand the list of documents that have to be produced in certain cases and certain lists, to eliminate presumptive production of certain documents that the other party is likely to have in the first place, or that it is very labor-intensive to produce. Ultimately, the discovery guideline points disputes over production back to the arbitrator for resolution. That's clear. The rule, as I said, was the proposed rule was published on June 11th. It's on our website, which again is www.finra.org. Now you might want to take a look at that. All right, so now we're past the initial pre-hearing conference and we're actually at the hearing, and this is where I think we want to spend most of our time. So moving to our third major topic, which how to manage the hearing. Let me start with...
Before we get to the third, could I just mention one quick thing?
Sure, you can.
I just want to emphasize the distinction between discovery and admissibility. Sometimes arbitrators confuse the two. It's one thing to allow discovery to see what you can find. Doesn't mean that it's going to be admitted at the hearing. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You're jumping ahead. I let everything in. I let just about everything in, and what I tell, I know we're going to deal with this in a few minutes, but I'll
deal with it now.
I tell the parties, assume it all comes in. And, you know, we'll deal with it at the time. Have a witness test, make sure you have a witness testify about it. But let's not waste time. We're going to get into streamlining the hearing process, but I let everything in for the most part, because we're arbitrators, we're not jurors. Go ahead.
And I know Gus doesn't entirely agree with it. It's okay. No.
That's okay.
Reasonable people disagree. Keep me in business. I like that.
I usually take things in for what they're worth.
The way to deserve.
Okay, managing the hearing. First things first, you know, arbitrator disclosure. I'm a little preachy on this one, but indulge me a minute here. You know, arbitrator impartiality is I think, the cornerstone of the forum. I mean, without that, we have nothing if people cannot trust the integrity and impartiality of the arbitrator. So let's start with a scenario here. You know, you get the pleadings in a case, you look them over, and then say the case involves an allegation that the broker made unsuitable investments to buy a particular stock. I won't mention any particular stock, but... Yeah, that's the case. It's a suitability claim. And you look at this and you say, well, all right, I don't own this stock, but, you know, I have a mutual fund that invests in this stock, and let's say it's 5% of the value. You can look it up on the prospectus, and you say, my gosh, you know, I have a mutual fund that I'm invested in, and they 5% of their holdings are the stock that's a question in this suitability claim. So do you disclose that?
To the specific question you're asking, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
And that's a threshold issue. And the first thing you've got to look at is where you draw the threshold. For example, I've had about 15,000 students over my years of teaching. Do I reveal the fact that somebody was a student at Fordham? Not really. I don't know. I don't care. And that's one threshold I don't go into. But other than that, you've got to be very careful that if there's any kind of a relationship between you and the party, or you have any kind of an interest, such as the example you just gave, you've got to disclose. Disclose, disclose, disclose is the byword. That doesn't mean you recuse yourself, but you disclose. And the point is to do your homework early, which means you go over the witness list, you go over the experts, and so on. Because it's one thing, the damage isn't done if you should recuse yourself before the hearing starts. But if all of a sudden you find out this conflict after 5 or 10 hearings, it makes it much, much more difficult. I had several situations of this happening after the hearing, after about 5 or 10 sessions, and it makes a difference whether the witness that you discover this conflict with is an expert witness or is a fact witness. If it's an expert witness, in this situation, the expert that was on the witness list was couldn't make it, so they got another witness. And the expert witness they happened to have gotten was a good friend of mine, Phil Hoblum. I disagreed with Phil many times and so on. I revealed the fact that I knew Phil well. I knew his writings. He knew my writings. We agreed on many things. We disagreed on many things. It would not have an impact in my decision at all. But I put it to the party. And the other side objected. Now, what I did under those circumstances, I weighed the balance. I knew I could have, would not have had bias, but I told the party who presented Phil, get yourself another expert in that case. That's the way I handled it in that case. On the other hand, I could have avoided it there, but if it was a fact witness, then the choice is a lot more difficult, where you really would have to either recuse yourself, you couldn't get rid of the fact witness, and then you'd have to go into a voir dire or whatever, and explore the relationship and whether or not it would affect your bias.
Gus is right. The watchword here is reasonable. And I've reviewed motions to vacate over the years. And this is one of the rare grounds that the court will vacate an award if there is failure to disclose actual conflict and strong inference of conflict. However, in this scenario, I disagree with the professor on disclosure. This scenario is you do not own any shares of the stock, but you own a mutual fund that has 5% of its value in the same stock. Should you disclose it? No. It's not reasonable. I have no idea what's in my mutual fund, and mutual funds can change their composition day to day. I think.
What if you did know? I mean, what if you're compulsive like me and you read all this stuff and you say, oh yeah, what if you knew?
You know, I know you want to say disclose, right, but I think it's unreasonable. I think that scenario is unreasonable. Okay, but let's say you feel you have to disclose. You've made the disclosure, and even looking at the arbitrator's manual as a guide, you don't believe a real or even an apparent conflict exists, but rather some association with parties or counsel or with the issues may be questioned. You've made the disclosure, but that disclosure doesn't mean that you should automatically withdraw from the panel. What happens next? You've made the disclosure. Yes, a mutual fund that I've had for 15 years has about 5% of this, one of the stocks at issue here. No conflict. What happens next, George?
Well, to be honest, I would think we might agree on this, that when you, before I answer your question, when you encounter, when a question arises in your mind about a disclosure, and that should arise because you've made some effort to find out if you have something to disclose. You can't. I guess we'd agree, don't worry about it and hope for the best, probably not the approach to take.
Mm-hmm.
So some reasonable effort to elicit, reasonable, underscore that, to determine whether you have something to disclose. But okay, let's. I thought I was asking the question.
But let me
okay.
just pick up on what David said. Over the years, some people have made a big issue that if you've sat on a panel with somebody who's trying a case with you, you've sat maybe 10 years ago as an arbitrator, that's some sort of a relationship. Well, if you brought it to my attention, I probably wouldn't have forgotten it. I would reveal it. Would I disqualify myself on that basis? Absolutely not. I mean, the fact that somebody sat on a panel with me 10 years ago would not disqualify me. And the reason I say that is because you've got to be careful also and mindful that that this issue does not become a game. All of a sudden, if you're losing the case, you start raising issues like that, and then no case would ever be tried. So you also have an obligation not to automatically recuse yourself just because it's an easy thing to do.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, something I will answer your question, but, you know, when in doubt, disclosure should be the rule. And I agree. The standard for disclosure, I think, is fairly low. It's a low threshold. What gets you removed is much,
and then
much
make
higher.
Your record why you're not recusing yourself.
So to get you, what happens afterward? I mean, basically, the first thing you have to do is ask yourself as arbitrators whether you think you can serve impartially. That's a question you ask yourself. And if you have any doubts, you should recuse yourself, which I guess we're using jargon here. I mean, you should excuse yourself from the case. Any doubts, you know, about whether in your mind you feel you can do this, take off. But assuming you think you can act impartially, FINRA will disclose the information. So we'll say to the parties, arbitrator, consortium, disclose the following, and we'll ask the parties for their views. Now, you know, one of two things can happen. If nobody challenges the arbitrator, obviously the arbitrator stays because the arbitrator has already had this self-discussion and feels he or she can serve. And the converse, if the parties all want the arbitrator to go, the arbitrator's got to go. I mean, that's pretty easy and straightforward. But sometimes the parties don't agree.
You've got to pay them for the session, though.
Yes, yes, of course. And lunch. But when the parties don't agree, you know, one of them can ask the arbitrator to step down. So a party can say, look, Professor Katsouris, you know, based on that disclosure, I think you should step down, and you can make the determination. Sometimes parties don't feel comfortable challenging the arbitrator directly, and they don't have to go to the arbitrator. They can come to FINRA and say, look, I think Katsouris needs to go. And, again, we'll elicit the viewpoints of the parties, in which case we'll make that decision. FINRA will make the decision. We looked at the criteria we just talked about. Is the relationship direct, substantial, continuing? Would someone look at this and reasonably believe the arbitrator has an interest in the case and can't be impartial? That's at a high level the standard. So we make that determination. Now, follow-up question is, well, who exactly is the we at FINRA? Basically, draw a line. You know, before the initial pre-hearing conference or hearing, staff will make that determination under delegated authority. After the hearings have commenced or the pre-hearing, at that juncture, only the director, that's literally me, or the president of FINRA Dispute Resolution, Linda Feinberg, can remove a sitting arbitrator after the hearings have commenced. And the grounds are a bit narrower. The party has to prove that the arbitrator essentially failed to disclose something material that should have been disclosed before. You know, it's just come to our attention that arbitrator so-and-so failed to disclose that they have a close relationship with one of the parties, and it turns out to be true. You can take a look at the customer code rules 12408-410. That's where all this material gets covered. All right, well, the two of you started to disagree on something, so let's move to civility and demeanor. Have either one of you encountered, I'm sure it's a hypothetical here, but in the course of the hundreds of hearings that you both served on, cases you've served on, and hundreds of hearings associated with those cases, do you ever encounter an attorney who conducts a belligerent cross-examination of a witness, you know, something that really borders on a personal attack?
In New York?
Never. I know. Somewhere else. Has it come up, and, you know, what'd you do, Gus?
Which counted?
Hypothetically.
Absolutely. There was an article which I happened to have penned 8 years ago in the Neutral Corner, Advocacy with Civility, a Prescription for Success, in the January 2001 Neutral Corner.
Also on the web, still there.
There were two points that I had made in that, that civility should extend not only to the arbitrators, but to the parties, to the representatives, to the witnesses, to the staff. It should be to everybody, and it should be the chairman that keeps civility going. If the chairman can't do it, or if the chairman is not willing to, I know I as an arbitrator would do it then. I would step into that role. I would not sit in an uncivil arbitration. And if the chairman cannot do that as a matter of course, then really they have no business being chairman. Some of the little things that I've used over the years, quite aside from levity sometimes to lessen the tension, I had one contentious two advocates. They had tried many cases against each other. They really disliked each other. And it was almost impossible to reason with them. One thing I did is I kept calling short breaks. I said, we're going to take 10 minutes out, come back, cool your heels, come on in. We did it about four or five times. They got the message. They got along. One of the other things is people interrupting on closing arguments. It happens all the time, and I knew it was going to happen in this case. So I told them, if I hear one peep when the other side is making their closing argument, we're going to have the closing arguments done by teleprompter. You will sit in another room and watch it on the screen. I don't know how I would have arranged it, George, but somehow you would have had to get a teleprompter. There wasn't a peep. So there are ways that you can show the parties that you mean business, but civility is extremely important if you want a fair hearing. And then, of course, there's other sanctions that you can go into. You might, first of all, if the parties are smart, they realize you're going to decide the case. So why aggravate the arbitrator to begin with? But then there are other sanctions also. But civility is very, very important.
I found that the best way to finesse the stability problem is not with a bludgeon, but with a subtle sense of humor. A little joking really works wonders, but you have to have confidence in your authority to do it. For example, if an attorney persists with speaking objections, you know what those are. I object, Mr. Chairman, because yesterday my client testified blah, 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 which he or she may never have said. If the attorney persists with speaking objections, gently ask him if he'd just like to be sworn in to testify. If an attorney persists in making objection after objection to interfere with the flow of the other party's presentation, say this: objection sustained, even if an objection hasn't been made. The offending attorney will say, "But Mr. Chairman, there was no objection." To which you should reply, "Well, there should have been." So that sort of jokingly, a soft approach, if they don't get it that way, you know, then you hit them over the head. As Gus said, if you see that the attorneys don't like each other, and that's pretty clear from their objections or their general conduct, ask the parties to step out of the room and ask the attorneys to remain. Then tell them, preferably off the record, that their bickering is counterproductive. Such bickering, you should say, tends to distract the arbitrators from the main issues in the case and won't be tolerated. Tell them you'd rather not put this on the record in front of your client, but that you will if they persist. Again, you have the power, you have the authority to do all of these things, but you need the courage of your conviction.
One other point, building on what Dave said, and that is sometimes attorneys set up the arbitrator, put things into the record, gratuitous comments. For example, if the chairman has already made up their mind on that motion, or some gratuitous statement like that, do not let that go. You stop and you say, "Excuse me, now I'm going to," and put on the record exactly what it is and why, and kind of reprimand them, because an arbitrator should not be set up. And a comment like that in a record on appeal looks terrible. So I always say, well, now let's stop there for a minute, and then I will explain my position so it's on a record. And it never happens again for that hearing.
All right, now here's another hearing-related question, and this one came in from one of our arbitrators, so we're going to cover it. The arbitrator wrote, I found it especially challenging dealing with pro se parties. Again, those are parties who represent themselves instead of hiring an attorney. What, if anything, should the arbitrator do to assist pro se parties and at the same time maintain their neutrality? I'll point out, under the Code of Arbitration Procedure, a party can have an attorney, but does not have to be represented. They can choose not to. So there's no requirement that they retain counsel. And I would say, you know, roughly 10% or so of the cases, a party chooses not to be represented by counsel. Usually smaller cases, but it happens. So, what are your obligations, or what do you do, Gus?
I'm very conscious of the fact of speed and economy and arbitration. On the other hand, if a party appears pro se, I must admit that I change my strategy a little bit. After all, there is a perception of fairness, which we have to portray to the outside world. We just had a survey at CICA as to the perception of fairness and so on and so forth. I'm also conscious about getting reversed on appeal and also a due process. I'm not saying that we delay things, but if a pro se party has difficulty in framing a question or it's leading and the other side objects, I will interject. First of all, I think you speed up the proceeding in the long run that way, and you also preserve that appearance of fairness, and I think even the integrity of the forum. On a pro se issue, it does throw things a little bit, slow things down, but you've got to change a little bit because of the fact that they're pro se.
Well, you know, it's human nature to try to help a pro se party understand the process, which to you is rather simple, but to that party, quite foreign. Some leeway, as Gus says, should be given, but not so that the case presentation becomes a debating society. It's in my experience that few pro se claimant customers know how to distinguish between an opening statement and the presentation of a case in chief. Few know that cross-examination means to ask a question and not make statements with a question mark at the end. Most pro se claimants don't properly structure their case, and they finish it far too soon, much too sooner than had they been represented by counsel. As such, they often fail to put on all the evidence you believe you need to make a fair decision. So after the customer is cross-examined, you'll probably want to ask more questions than normal, but that's a good thing. Just be judicious in your questioning. In the end, however, pro se parties should have no special privileges just because they didn't have an attorney at the dam.
I agree with that. No special privileges.
And on the FINRA webpage, in the dispute resolution portion, there's an area called Materials for Parties, and there are guides there on how what to expect, how the case will proceed. So a party that does choose not to be represented by counsel, it doesn't go totally alone. There are fairly extensive materials on how the process works and what to expect. Although I would think you might spend more time as an arbitrator in the opening statement, in your opening of the hearing, just kind of laying out what the process is going to be so the pro se party would understand that there's going to be an opening statement. Each side will get a chance. Please don't interrupt in the middle. You'll get your turn. Not evidence, and then each side gets a chance to put on their testimony.
Sure, the most interesting pro se case I ever had was I asked for opening statements, and the pro se claimant took two shopping bags out, emptied them on the table, and pushed about 500 pieces of paper towards me as chairman.
I rest my case.
That's about it. And I had to try the case for him, and we ruled against him. But I preserved the record. I thought I had due process.
There's a wonderful line in the movie The Verdict where the judge takes over the case. Who is the lead in that movie? Is that Paul Newman, I think?
Yeah.
Says, Your Honor, if you're going to take over my case, for God's sake, don't lose it for me. So I guess be careful. All right. We talked before about postponement and the disruption that can cause to parties. So let's imagine this scenario. You've been sitting on a case. You've had a few hearings. Let's say today's Thursday, then the next group of hearings are going to take place Monday. And over the weekend, this coming weekend, you or a close family member are hospitalized, and you want to contact the parties to say, look, I can't show up on Monday, and you probably don't want to show up either. Something like that. Or the weekend before the first, the hearing, the party settles. So they want to tell you. know, that that they're done and you don't need to show up. You know, how do you deal with that, Dave?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, George, because I'm in a case right now where that issue has come up and the arbitrators needed guidance. So I said, you know, maybe we can deal with that question at today's teleconference. You know, if the parties have agreed to direct communication, that thing that I'm a real advocate of, if they've agreed to direct communication on discovery issues, the parties know how to communicate with the chair directly. That's by email or by fax. So if at the IPHC any hearing dates have been scheduled for a Monday, tell the parties that if they resolve their case over a weekend or an emergency arises, they should send an email or a fax to the chair, who can then contact the two wings. The chair can get the contact information.
Oh, I'm sorry, the two wings are who? Two other arbiters?
The two other arbiters, we call them the wings. The chair can get the contact information of the other two arbitrators from them directly without sharing it with the parties. I do this when I chair cases. If any hearing is scheduled for Monday, the chair should make it a habit to check his or her email or fax machine on Sunday night to make sure there isn't a need to put off the hearing. Everyone will appreciate this simple, what I call, emergency pod fallback procedure. I was recently involved in an industry case where I'm representing respondents, and this came up. Or the wife of the claimant's attorney had emergency surgery. She had to have it on Monday. The arbitrators were contacted Sunday by email, and no one had to go to the expense and aggravation to show up that Monday.
Also, the staff are very interested in the weather. And if there's a forecast, you know, in the Boca office of a hurricane or some other weather event coming, or up here in the Northeast and in the winter, a storm coming, they'll take contact information home with them and we'll deal with that if they have to make sure, you know, the question will come up, for example, are you open? Are we going to have hearings that day? And so forth. And I think the technology ultimately will help in this area. But, Dave, I think you're absolutely right in terms of how the direct communication rule can really help in this area. These days of cell phones now, it's not hard to get hold of people as it was in the past.
Okay. Two things, George, on that. Number one, in every case, at the very beginning, the chairman should get the telephone numbers and fax numbers of the panelists, in case they have to communicate with each other, not just on an emergency, but for other reasons. Secondly, Dave, I know, is a big fan of direct communication, but it doesn't always work or it's not always in place. I do recommend something be put in place. Secondly, even if you had direct communication, I may be flying back from the coast on a red eye coming to a hearing, and I may not be, you may not be able to contact me. I don't think it's that big an imposition that each regional office of the NASD, somebody is on call each weekend or whatever it is. I don't think it's a great expense either, where they would man that number and all emergency things would be, and he would then disseminate to the parties. I don't think that would be a bad idea to at least to try out. If you have 50 people each weekend, somebody is on that call to man that number to get these emergency communications.
This has become a very expensive process, arbitration. And if you do a case out of town, you bring in all your documents, you bring in your witnesses, you bring in yourself, and you all show up on a Monday, and one of the arbitrators gets sick over the weekend. This is horrible for the process. It's very aggravating. It's very time-consuming.
Okay. I'll give my number out at the end of the call. And I'll try to pile it up at the first. But
George's cell phone number is.
Okay. Now, but you're at the hearing, and there's a grinding examination of a witness and cross-examination. And, you know, as arbitrators, you know, you're going to be patient, let counsel question witnesses or do cross-examination. And then after this thorough examination and cross-examination, you're sitting there saying, well, gee, I really need to know, you know, no one's asked about this key thing I need to know. You know, for example, well, was the check cashed? Anyone ever canceled? Something like that. So, you know, what do you do? I mean, at that point, you know, again, the witness has been presented, cross is dotted, there's no redirect. Well, and it's the next witness, and you think, well, I need to know that. So, you know what, Gus? You just let it, you not worry about it and hope for the best, or do you do something?
I usually let attorneys try their case. On the other hand, sometimes I interrupt and apologize because I may forget the question, or let's handle it now so I don't have to do the introductory remarks so that you understand the question I'm asking. And if at the end of the day, the particular witness, there's a key part that I think that the witness knows about, and it's a question that I have to have answered to decide the case, in good conscience, although I'm reluctant to do it in most cases, in good conscience, I've got to ask the question. Otherwise, how can I decide the case in good conscience? So I probably would ask the question.
You know, I was giving more thought to this question last night, and it is a balancing act, as Gus says. We as arbitrators have to decide the cases based on the evidence presented to us. Claimants have the burden of proof. If you think that the claimant hasn't fulfilled her burden, but could do so by a few more questions, I believe that you should ask those questions if you want. Listen, you're not a potted plant, but you're also not the party's advocate. You're there to dispense justice equitably. And I gave a lot of thought to this, and that's what I feel.
All right, now let's look at your co-arbitrators. Have either of you had a case where it was evident to one of your fellow arbitrators, not you, of course, but your fellow arbitrators wasn't paying attention? I'm not going to get into sleeping arbitrators. You know, I hear that all the time, and you know, if we had an army of narcoleptic arbitrators, we would have heard about it by now. But just an arbitrator just doesn't seem to be paying attention. And you know, what do you do?
What I try to do it subtly, George. I'll either
kick them under
the table, or and one of the issues also is when the eyelids start closing, I don't spill a cup of coffee on them, but I rustle my coffee or I move the papers.
I'm talking about distracted arbitrators.
No, look, I can't decide a case for each arbitrator. They have to decide it for themselves. You can influence them during the course of the thing. I've also, on occasion, if there's a disagreement, you shouldn't try to show it in public. I had, out of the 200 cases, maybe in one or two cases, I had where, for one reason or another, my fellow arbitrator was very upsetting. And what I do is I try not to have these disruptions public. I hold an executive session, and we'll try and iron it out privately. I try to get along very well with my arbitrators. At the end of the day, they're going to vote the way they want to, and it's your job, I guess. But A, as a chairman, make sure they're awake, paying attention. And if they are too aggressive, I think either at a break or an executive session as chairman, I think I would mention it to them in a friendly manner.
Yeah, it's another delicate issue. I guess that's why you asked it. Executive sessions are important. With the parties out of the room, it's just the three of you. I have to tell you, is one of the jobs I have as chairing the neutral roster subcommittee of the NEMC is that we get reports of arbitrators who are like this, who don't pay attention, and their fellow arbitrators have problems with that, or they come unprepared, or they come late. Arbitrators will be permanently struck from the roster.
How about playing with their BlackBerry?
Yeah. You can kind of, the subtle hint. Someone's looking down and in the middle of a riveting cross-examination, they go, oh my gosh, pork bellies are crashing. And you know, that kind of non sequitur gets your attention. What do you use on BlackBerries in the hearing?
They should not be permitted. Cell phones should be shut off. Everyone should focus, as we're focusing, on the evidence. It's rude. It's not civil.
I think they're exceptions. If there's some situation, I think you have to say something. You know, like you're. Oh, I don't know, you're daughter is about to go into labor or something like that. And you're waiting for the call.
Like your daughter. Like your daughter today is waiting to give birth.
My phone's off. She's got to hang on. My phone's off. But now, if there's some situation where you're expecting, in a really odd situation where it's really important for you to get a call, then you say, I think you need to inform the parties about this exceptional situation, but they're rare. I would agree. And let me get a little bit of commercial about peer evaluations. Now, FINRA has a peer evaluation system. The forms are on the web, and that's where arbitrators evaluate each other. I agree. You're absolutely right. You know, you deal with this in the middle of the case when it happens during executive session or otherwise, but it's important to get feedback to the staff about these things. So at a minimum, I would encourage arbitrators to complete peer evaluations. And we won't necessarily remove an arbitrator permanently. Sometimes it's counseling. You know, we'll say, look, you know, this is really not okay. It's not acceptable behavior. Enough of that. Okay. I guess our last question, replacement arbitrators. Now, let's imagine you've had several hearings and arbitrator withdraws. This is a question that came in from one of the arbitrators. Several hearings have taken place and arbitrator withdraws from the panel. Very frustrating. Sometimes it just happens. Arbitrator dies. Frustrating as well. You know, there's a vacancy. And the parties do have the option under the code to continue with the two remaining arbitrators, so they don't always do that. So let's assume they don't. So now the parties want to replace the arbitrator. And then, you know, we call you. We ask you to accept. What do you do to get yourself up to speed? Let's say there have been, you know, seven hearings. What do you, how do you get up to speed? And then we'll talk about whether you should be compensated for that effort. But let's start with, what do you do to get up to speed?
I wouldn't take the case unless I had the time to go through the record. I mean, otherwise you're not doing a fair, you're not doing a fair job. Unless I had time to as though I was there from the very beginning. Otherwise, I think you're fooling yourself and you're fooling the other parties.
Well, I greatly appreciate arbitrators who are willing to do this. I have rarely seen parties agree to just continue with two arbitrators, even though most awards are unanimous decisions. It's tough, and it shows the best of our arbitrators when they agree to do this. They need to find out what happened. How do you do that? You can listen to the tapes, which are sometimes problematic. If there's a transcript, you should look at the transcript. Ideally, you should do both. While you're listening to the tape, read the transcript to get a feel of what happened. But if it's in the middle of a case and you're there at the next hearing, you may want the parties to give a sum up. What's happened so far? You need to be creative, but this is where arbitrators truly show how good they are as people when they agree to step in. The parties have invested a great deal of money and time and their life into these cases, and they need your help. And so I greatly appreciate arbitrators who are willing to do this. But, George, they don't do it for free.
So that was a follow-up question from this arbitrator. Does FINRA pay study time? That's not a term I'm familiar with. It's not in the Code of Arbitration Procedure. But, you know, as a matter of fairness, arbitrators spend time in these situations, as you said, reviewing transcripts or listening to tapes, and you know, sometimes extensive, voluminous material. So these are exceptional circumstances, and FINRA will pay an additional honoraria for the arbitrator's reasonable time. The arbitrator says, well, you know, I spent a morning doing this, that's a hearing session, or an entire day, or two mornings, two evenings, et cetera. We will pay an additional honoraria for doing that activity. Let me underscore, we don't charge the parties. You know, FINRA absorbs the cost. Really, as a matter of fairness, it's not appropriate to say, you know, spend your Sunday reading these materials. Thank you very much. Your first honorarium comes with tomorrow's hearing. That doesn't seem quite right. Well, you know, our time is about up. This hour has flown by. Any closing comments, Dave?
Yeah, you know, since arbitration is intended to be that efficient and less costly process than litigation, you have the authority to manage the process efficiently, such as taking witnesses out of order, having them testify by phone. A lot of people look better on the phone. Skipping the voir dire portion for experts. You're going to let the expert in. By skipping the voir dire session, But you saved an hour. If the expert needs to be challenged, that can be done on cross-examination. Exhibit, let them all in.
Scott.
Be flexible. No two arbitrations are the same. I mean, we've given a lot of opinions here today, and yet I know as each new case comes in, something new comes up. So there is deviation, but you've got to be sometimes a little bit original. You've got to be forceful. You've got to be civil. And you've got to do justice at the end of the day. And I never, when I go into an arbitration, even think about what my record has been in the 200 cases. Maybe Rick Ryder knows, but I don't care. Each case is got to be given the justice it deserves, and I don't even remember what my record is, and I don't want to know.
You're right.
Well, one thing, you mentioned teleconferences. We have, FINRA has video conferencing facilities in our offices, and the important, we have them in New York, Boca, L.A. is, I think, next, Washington, D.C., Chicago. So that's a possibility as well. You know, and this technology now is no longer that exotic. It exists. And, you know, and very often arbitrators express concerns about telephonic testimony because you can't judge facial expressions and so forth. So this is an option, and it over time will become more and more available in more and more of our facilities. And we're also in the midst, by the way, of installing digital audio equipment as well.
Although I will travel to Hawaii or Paris, George.
Sometimes you just have to be there. Well, you know, once again, I want to thank Gus and Dave for sharing their experience and wisdom with our audience today. It's been a lot of fun. The time just flew by. And I want to thank all the arbitrators who called in for today's call. You don't need these are valuable learning tools, and we're going to, of course, continue to do these on a quarterly basis. For those arbitrators out there who immediately after the call send us an email saying I completed the call, you don't need to do that. We know that you've completed the call, so there's no need to send us an update stating that you attended the workshop. Just a reminder: immediately following today's call, we'll send participants an email containing a downloadable link to the audio file of today's call, and that allows you to listen to a free replay of the workshop if there's something you missed or you want to check. You can do that. And then within, I guess, no more than about a week, we will post on the web page an audio file of today's call. And again, the web address is www.finra.org. You just go to the arbitration and mediation tab on the home page, and that'll take you right to our little corner of FINRA's web page. We hope you enjoyed today's workshop and found it informative. Our next call will take place in the fall. In the meantime, have a wonderful summer, and thanks again to everyone for participating. Bye-bye.